The following podcast contains explicit language.
Hello, and welcome to the Live Forever edition of Slate Money, your guide to the business and finance news of the week. I am Felix Salmon of Fusion. I am joined, as ever, by Cathy O'Neill, the data scientist and author of Weapons of Mass Destruction.
Hello, Felix.
And calling in from the distant clime of Austin, Texas, is Jordan Weissman.
Thankfully, we do have the technology for me to connect and share this wonderful morning with you guys.
So we are going to be devoting this entire episode to, well, living forever. You know that thing that vampires do? I need to tell the story because on Thursday night last week, I went to the opera because I'm a sophisticated kind of gentleman. I went to see Yennefer at the Met, which is one of Janáček's greatest operas. And the Kostelnica character, the sort of tragic, evil stepmother character, at the beginning of Act 3 has this whole speech about how, because she's so tragic, she can't wait to die, basically, and that living forever is a really horrible thing, which is a bit of a theme in Janáček operas, because as Cathy will remember in the Micropolis case, you know, Emilia Micropolis is like 330 years old, and the whole opera is all about how she realizes that because she took a magic potion, and you know, it's the opera, and then at the end she rapidly ages and dies and welcomes death rather than trying to live for another 338 years. And it's all about this idea, and there's this theme running through Janáček, which is basically that immortality is much worse than it's cracked up to be, which is also a theme running through most vampire novels, I think.
Yeah, and I would also jump in and say the fact that it was a woman who said, living forever isn't what I actually want. And we're going to come back to that, because I honestly think that living forever is a thing that only men want to do.
So it was funny because my wife, who I went to see the opera with, when we were walking out of it, said, wow, I'm kind of surprised that this early 20th century opera by a guy was so feminist. So, Cathy,
yeah,
tell us about immortality and like, what is it that these men want to do?
Yeah. Well, listen, I'm wrong about the only men want to do this, because this Bloomberg journalist found a bunch of people in Russia who want to live forever.
These are the transhumanists of Russia.
Yeah. So they, in particular, I mean, actually, it's not completely fair to say they want to live forever. Some of them want to live forever. But what they're actually doing in Russia and, of course, in the United States is they're cryogenically freezing themselves at death. And the goal of that may or may not be to live forever. The goal is definitely to reawaken at some time in the future when, like, science has progressed to the point of being able to revive people who have been cryogenically frozen. But only some of those people say the ultimate goal is to live forever. Some of them just literally want to see what happens in 4,000 years or something.
Maybe like what I feel like is, if I've got 80 years to live, maybe what I want to do is spend my first 40 years right here, right now, cryogenically freeze myself. Wake up in another 200 years and then spend my second 40 years in 200 years' time when the world is going to be much richer and happier.
Right.
And, you know, just to be clear, these people aren't all expecting necessarily to be revived in their full bodies. Some of them have ideas. Like, for instance, they might have their brain uploaded onto a computer at some point. There's sort of a variety. It's not all just... So it's not all just bringing corpses back from the dead. They have sort of a lot of different sci-fi visions.
It's quite popular in cryogenic circles to freeze only your head, because it's considered that your body is just this sort of extraneous organ which you can do without.
Yes, and thanks for bringing that up, because it allows me to insert magically some numbers that gives us an excuse to talk about this stuff in the first place on Slate Money, namely the price that you would have to pay to be cryogenically frozen. It's actually called cryonics. And to be clear, it is it's only legal for like people who are already dead. You're not allowed to do this to someone just because they're 40 and want to spend the next 40 years.
Although they're trying to do, what did they call it? Cryogenic euthanasia in Russia, the first person.
In Switzerland.
In Switzerland.
Okay, so what actually happens is they sort of like use liquid nitrogen to bring you down to a temperature where everything is like frozen and it kind of turned into some kind of glass type structure. And the question of how much it costs. Okay, so there's two different companies in the United States that'll do it, and one of them will cost $200,000, which is a lot, but it also includes just basically your body is kept safe until the moment comes when they're going to revive you, and that's by Alcor. And then there's a Cryonics Institute which only charges $28,000 for a whole body preservation, and then listen, in Russia it's actually cheaper than that. So you $36,000 for your whole body, but only $12,000 if you just want to do your head.
But we have been down this road in the past that people do this kind of pay us up front and we'll preserve you in perpetuity thing. And then they get paid up front and then they spend all of the money and then they just kind of throw the bodies away because the bodies aren't going to sue them.
Actually, that's really true. And in fact, like basically in the 60s and 70s, this kind of got as popular as an idea. And it lost a lot of allure when they found out that was actually happening, that they just sort of ran out of liquid nitrogen and were letting people sort of decompose.
Although that said, from the point of view of someone who might cryogenically preserve himself, which for the record, I will not, I can see how that's just one of the many, many, many risks involved in this. Like, we know that there's probably, even if everything goes according to plan and the cryogenics works perfectly, there's probably only a 1% chance that I'll ever sort of rise from the dead, as it were. So, you know, if there's also a percentage chance that the cryogenics company goes bust and I get, like, tipped into a garbage heap somewhere, that's just another risk, which I'm willing to take.
If you think about, you know, this is sort of a rich man's game, right? This is actually in a lot of ways a small bet with a potentially big payoff, right? I mean, the chance, it's a very, very low probability that this will happen. But if it only costs you $12,000 to do it and you are a Russian billionaire, I mean, that's the equivalent of me going out to lunch, right? So all the risks involved, whether or not it works, whether or not it actually pays off and you get to upload your brain onto a computer and, you know, or rise from the dead, it's a very small upfront bet with potentially exponential, with infinite returns in a way, if you actually might get to live forever.
And I want to talk a little bit about these returns since we're in the realm of like crazy sci-fi right now. And we're going to, just to be clear, bring this back down to earth in a minute, like in the next segment. But since this is the crazy sci-fi segment, there are really big problems with people living forever, like economic problems. That what happens is that it's incredibly bad for inequality. If you're a Russian billionaire or anyone else, if you live forever, and this is also a standard trope in vampire fiction, you just by dint of the power of compound interest, basically, you wind up being incredibly wealthy. And the more people who, and in general, people get richer as they get older. And as you have people getting to 200 or 300 years old, all of the wealth will start accumulating among the super, super old. And it's going to be very weird and bad for the economy.
It's going to be bad for society, too. I mean, one of the major reasons that I don't want anyone else to live forever is because, you know, our society changes, evolves, and a large part of how it evolves, and I typically think of society evolving and progressing and getting better. And like a large part of that is like old people die, you know, like the old racists will die eventually, and then we can move on from there. And the idea of not letting those people die is actually really scary to me.
And the idea that you can preserve property rights while you're dead, you know, that you die and then you're cryogenically frozen and then you wake up and then somehow you still own all of the property which you owned when you died, is it goes against basically all property law.
Yeah, I mean, here's the main thing, right? It is actually not that hard to produce humans. Like, people do it all the time. It's called having babies. So for me, it brings up a thought experiment, which is like, under what conditions would we actually need to revive these frozen brains?
What on earth makes us think that we humans of today have more right to be alive in 200 years than the humans of 200 years' time?
Like, imagine a society where we're like, oh my God, what will we do unless we could revive those old brains? And if we don't have that situation, like, why would we revive those old brains?
And there might be a handful of old brains that we want to revive, like, you know, Mozart or Shakespeare or someone, but they're not generally the billionaires who want to live forever.
And those are, by the way, those are exactly who they always talk about. They're like, Steve Jobs died, and that was a shame for our civilization. Therefore, I must be frozen.
Let's leave aside whether or not these people actually will live forever, if they will succeed in their quest. One thing the Bloomberg article talked about that I thought was really interesting is that in the way a lot of kind of funky, low-probability science sometimes does, there might be, you know, interesting side effects to this. There might be other things that come of this research. Like, you know, there a lot of people want to figure out how to freeze specific organs, right, so that they can be held on a shelf, essentially, and just kept in stock for organ donations in the future.
I think that was a movie with Ewan McGregor and Scarlett Johansson.
I mean, that could also, there could be other sci-fi, other sci-fi-esque problems where you actually just have people, you know, I think it's like Never Let Me Go, essentially, you're eventually going to be harvested. But the, I mean, so if we want to go down that route, yeah, that can be dystopian too. But the point being, there are actual medical applications to freezing dead people that might do a lot of good in the world. And yes, they do have to deal with life extension, but in a more conventional way. Just, again, people who need new hearts, who need new livers. And so if this ends, if this convinces more rich people who wouldn't necessarily be funneling their money elsewhere, because this is sort of a selfish aim to kind of fund this research, maybe that's a good thing.
And that is a perfect segue into our next segment.
Apple Card is the perfect cash back rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
Jordan, when you talk about the importance of basic science, One of the people that you're sort of weirdly whispering into the ear of is Mark Zuckerberg and his wife Priscilla Chan, who between them have created this thing called the Chan Zuckerberg Initiative. And the Chan Zuckerberg Initiative recently announced this thing called Chan Zuckerberg Science, which is a $3 billion commitment to curing all disease. I'm not even making this up. This is their stated commitment, is that they want to cure all disease by the end of the century.
In typical Silicon Valley, it's a very humble approach to a really difficult topic.
I mean, so this is a fascinating project. They are, so it's maybe more, maybe less than it sounds. It's $3 billion over 10 years. So, you know, if you compare it to the kind of money that's pouring out of the CDC and the NIH and that kind of stuff, it's tiny, but it's still billions of dollars. It's still, you know, big on an absolute level. And of that, they're spending $600 million on this thing called the BioHub, which is a research center in San Francisco, where they're going to take people from Stanford and Berkeley and UCSF and bring them all together. And basically what they do is they look at the world and they say more than half of all of the deaths in the world are caused by four things. One, heart disease. Two, infectious disease. Three, neurological disease. And four, cancer. So let's do some really basic level, basic research on trying to prevent or cure or at least manage those four things. And we are going to do absolutely amazing things for the quality of life around the world.
You know, two things I really like about this is that they chose these ideas, these are the four topics, based on how many people die from them every year, which is the right way of doing it. Like a truly selfish, like rich person would have been like, oh, this is like what my friends died of that I miss, right? So they did that right. I don't know how much, you know, how much their approach to it, which seems to be like pairing scientists with engineers, how, like, why do they think that's going to work?
So one of the things that they have is this idea of a cell atlas, which has been around for a long. Well, the idea has been around for a long time. Obviously, a couple of decades ago, there was this idea of like mapping the human genome, and everyone spent billions of dollars, and eventually they did it, and now you can do it for a couple thousand bucks, and it's like, wow, we've mapped the human genome. The cell atlas is a lot more complicated than mapping the human genome, but it's doable, and it's basically a way of indexing all of the different cell types in the body and the different states that those cells can be in, and so that you can design drugs for any given disease because you know all of the cells and all of the states they can be in, and you can try and work out how to fix that on a cell-by-cell basis. So that's like, you can see how that's a technology problem at least as much as it is a medicine problem. Or for instance, for the neurological disease, there's talk about using AI software to help with imaging the brain so that you can sort of model this thing and work out how it works and therefore how to fix it. They're even thinking of doing things like continuous bloodstream monitoring. Again, this is a technological problem where you put something in your blood and then it will tell you very, very early if, you know, something is going wrong with what's in your blood. So I'm not completely skeptical about the idea that, like, engineers can have a role to play here.
Are you skeptical about the amount of money, I mean, that they can actually accomplish this with the amount of money they're putting forward? I mean, you know, $3 billion, the comparison a lot of people make is that's less than a tenth of what the annual NIH budget is, you know?
Right, and that's $3 billion over 10 years. So yeah. We're talking about like a hundredth, basically.
So in that's like, the way I think about this is that the NIH possibly spends a lot of money on like overhead and things about treating the symptoms of diseases, but these guys are like looking exactly to solve the problem at its base.
So I think, yeah, what this Chan Zuckerberg people will say, and what Mark Zuckerberg actually did say when he announced this, was that our country as a whole, like, put NIH funding to one side, but like look at total healthcare funding. That we're spending 50 times more on treating sick people than we are on trying to cure diseases so that people don't get sick in the first place. And it seems, from his point of view at least, because he's got this very low, what you might call intergenerational equity discount rate, he values unborn people in 100 years' time as almost as valuable as someone who's alive today. So if you could spend $1 billion on treating 10,000 people right now who have a disease, or you can spend that $1 billion and cure the disease so that 2 million people don't get the disease in 60 years' time, he would rather do the latter because he reckons that those future lives, many of whom aren't even born yet, are just as valuable as the present lives. Whereas the way that the health system is set up right now is that it's all about present lives rather than unborn future lives.
Question. Is this a money-making thing? Are they going to actually make profit off of this?
It's not designed to make money. There are various little bits of incentives in there to get researchers on board, and they retain the rights to a certain amount of IP. It's not all open source and public, but I think it's easy to, you know, quibble with the way that they've designed it. This Chan Zuckerberg Initiative is famously not a philanthropy. It's set up as an LLC. It's a for-profit entity, which gives them a lot more freedom to use different ways of incentivizing researchers rather than just like saying, we're going to pay you a paycheck and you're going to do lots of good work. And maybe that's good that they can keep a certain amount of optionality there.
You know, I guess they're kind of going back to Felix's point about future generations versus, current generations. There is one other aspect to that moral calculus, which is, you know, and you'll hear some public health advocates bring this up, is that they're paying attention to these kind of four disease areas and trying to say, okay, over 100 years, we can cure, or, you know, within their daughter's lifetime, we can cure all of them by, again, taking these sort of moonshots, trying to do a cell map. But at the same time, there are very simple or very direct things we can do now to, you know, help millions of people in the developing world who deal with infectious diseases, malaria, things that just kill lots and lots and lots of people right now that we don't need a moonshot for. We just need better implementation of public health strategies. And so there are some people, I think, who are a little bit frustrated that they're not going more of a Bill Gates route kind of with dealing with things in the here and now.
I think that's unfair, to be honest, because, I mean, number one, Bill Gates is going the Bill Gates route. The Gates Foundation is even bigger than the Chan Zuckerberg Initiative, and Bill Gates and people like the One Campaign have proved themselves extremely effective at creating things like Gavi, which is the Global Alliance for Vaccines, which has done amazing jobs at bringing HIV/AIDS drugs to sub-Saharan Africa and that kind of stuff. These are ultimately, the way that these programs work is always that you spend a certain amount of money as a sort of proof of concept, and then you schmooze a bunch of people in Davos and you try and get governments to get on board, and then you scale them up at a government level. That's not an engineering problem. That's not Zuckerberg's comparative advantage. Honestly, I think Bono is better than Mark Zuckerberg is. And it's not actually something where having $3 billion particularly helps you. What you really need is having the ear of the various health ministers and the WHO and that kind of thing. So I don't really buy that criticism, but I think there are like very interesting philosophical implications of what they're doing here. And I think, you know, because this is the Live Forever episode, one of the things which has been kind of bugging me ever since they announced this goal is this idea of, well, if we cure all disease, what are we going to die of?
Exactly what I was wondering, yeah.
And it turns out that this isn't... So what I was worried about is that this is just another version of transhumanism, sort of in a philanthropic disguise, that if we cure all disease, we're all just going to live forever until we just get run over by a bus.
And I have to say the PR works on me. Like, I'm disgusted by the idea of people living forever, but I'm like, oh, I hope they can help cure disease. And like, look, what's wrong with me? There's like,
But that's what we die of, exactly. and the idea is that, you know, a certain part of this world, the cure-all disease world, the moonshot world, thinks of aging as a disease.
Yes.
But a lot of it does not. The people working on cancer, the people working on heart disease, you know, the people really, you know, even working on the Cell Atlas aren't really focused on this idea of aging as a disease. And I think the general idea is basically that the human body is a bit like a MacBook. You know, it's just something which when it reaches a certain age, it's going to break down. And even if there's nothing particularly wrong with it, you have organs. If your organs are 100 years old, they're just going to break down at some point and you're going to die. And that's, you know, you can probably specify in some kind of diagnostic manual somewhere, like what technical disease it was that caused your organ to fail. But I don't think that's the kind of disease that they're concentrating on.
Yet.
Until Peter Thiel takes over.
Exactly. And yeah, but at the same time, you're absolutely right. This is Silicon Valley. Peter Thiel is on Mark Zuckerberg's board, and he's famously into this idea of parabiosis, which is basically vampirism.
I don't know anything about this. Is Peter Thiel weird in yet another way?
Oh, yeah. In case you haven't been weirded out enough by Peter Thiel, he's obsessed by these experiments which show that if you take the blood of young mice and you inject that blood and you use that blood to replace the blood of old mice, and the old mice live longer and are healthier.
Okay, let me just say that I do not want Peter Thiel to live forever.
But like, just to tie this up, the question of relative funding and stuff, obviously the NIH is has much bigger funding and they do support basic science. I think one of the things which people are excited about when it comes to the biohub is that you don't have a huge amount of pressure to be publishing papers, to be showing that your research is really going somewhere within a sort of 3-year period, and that they can spend a lot of time and a lot of money studying things in depth without having to publish, without having to write grant applications to the NIH and that kind of stuff. And that if they have that kind of freedom, then maybe that will help them at the margin. I can kind of buy that.
Until the Zuckerberg Foundation like comes up with their own accountability scheme, right? But they're going to do that.
Well, they may or may not, because I think one of the interesting things about the new generation of philanthropists is that they like the idea of philanthropic capital as being sort of like venture philanthropy, as having like a 90% chance of failing, but if it succeeds, then the world gets transformed. So they're not necessarily going to be put off by, you know, someone failing for a long time. We will see.
We'll see.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Jordan.
Yes.
Let's talk about money, because this is actually Slate Money.
Yeah, sure. Earlier on, you were talking about our attempts to map the human genome and how this was one of the great successes of the early 2000s and how a lot of people in medicine and policy hoped it would bring about this, you know, kind of new era of very personalized care where we could look at our genetic code for each individual and see what cancers, you know, we're predisposed to, if we're predisposed to Alzheimer's or heart disease, and come up with very specific treatment regimens. And then on top of that, try to come with, preventative care. And, you know, we were kind of talking about this question before the show of how much this would end up costing, right? Is this going to bring down the cost of medical care long term, or is it going to make medicine more expensive for everyone? And the jury's still out on that, but I was reading up on reactions from people, you know, from doctors, from people in the medical field. And there seems to be this consensus that right now, at least, we should expect personalized care to actually make medicine a lot more expensive, if for no other reason than we're at a stage where it's not that refined. We still haven't really figured out all the nuances of the genome, but we do know enough of it that we can look at people's genetic map and get a vague sense of what they might be in danger, what diseases they might be in danger of eventually ending up with. And it might end up with just a bunch of unnecessary care. And that's a lot of preemptive medicine that doesn't necessarily preempt anything.
So we have a lot of false positives. And I think there was an article this week, Jordan, I think you shared it with us, so that if you take up all these like five different versions of genetic tests from five different companies, they'll likely show you that you have risks for different diseases, and some of them will actually contradict each other.
Yeah.
Even if you don't have the false positives, the cost of these technologies, like gene sequencing, is thousands of dollars now rather than billions that it used to be. So it's come down a lot, but it's still thousands of dollars. The new hotness right now is CRISPR, of course, gene editing. And again, everyone's like, this is so cheap. You can do it for like $100,000. And you're like, yeah, but that's not, you know, even if it comes down, when everyone starts editing their own genes and sequencing their own genes and everything starts becoming personalized and technological.
Can you say more about gene editing? I didn't even know that we did that. What does that mean?
So, yeah,
Before birth, or is that?
No, this is after. This is when, you know, you have genes.
This sounds science fiction.
And there's this woman called Jennifer Doudna in Berkeley who invented this process called CRISPR, C-R-I-S-P-R. And it allows you to go in and take out your genes and fiddle around with them and take out the thing which is bad and put it back in and fix you that way.
Wow.
Yeah.
What kind of application does this have?
It has a million applications, but mostly medical. And there are definitely people who are talking in kind of crazy eugenic terms in places like Russia. The great thing or the bad thing about CRISPR is that it is really quite cheap and easy. Anyone can do it. The technology is not difficult. So even if there's a bunch of bioethicists in the United States who are all over preventing people from using it to, you know, try and create some kind of ubermensch, that doesn't mean that people aren't going to be able to do that in the rest of the planet. But it is, from a purely medical perspective, it does create layers of expense and complexity. And I guess my question for Jordan is, as all of these technologies come on stream, what happens to the cost of healthcare, which is already like high? Does it just get crazily higher? Do we wind up in an economy where 50% of the economy is healthcare?
Well, you know, it depends, I think, on a lot of different factors, right? You know, you look at a system like, and a lot of it depends on how your healthcare system is set up, right? Like you look at the U.S., where essentially you can have insurers decide, and we're not going to cover, you know, all this genetic mapping, all genetic testing. We don't think the payoff is enough. You still might have a situation where people are going and saying, you know what, I'll pay a few thousand dollars to go and, you know, take this test and see what I'm predisposed to get, what disease is supposedly going to kill me down the line. And then once they have those results, they can say, oh, well, I'm now going to seek all these treatments and try to, you know, do everything in my power to avoid whatever, you know, whatever congestive heart failure in the future. And that could eventually, and, you know, maybe that person actually does maybe that person actually does take care better care of themselves and it brings down health costs in the future, or maybe they just go and seek a bunch of unnecessary care. And if you have a bunch of people seeking unnecessary care because of these tests, then yeah, it drives up the cost. It drives up costs for everyone. Because
and it's not just the tests; it's also the treatments. When the treatments are personalized,
absolutely. It's well, it is. It's not the tests. Like that's exactly a point. It's the stuff that you do after the tests. You know, you can try to have a national healthcare system. You know, if you have universal healthcare, say we're not going to pay for CRISPR, or we're not going to pay for these, you know, to have each and every individual have their genetic, you know, their genome sequenced. But it's harder to stop them from going and doing all the stuff afterwards.
No, I mean, I think it's worse than that. Like the point of gene editing and CRISPR is not just to diagnose problems or potential problems, it's actually to treat them. So if I don't take any test, but I just walk into the doctor one day and I'm symptomatic and I have some problem, they can then turn around and say, oh, we can probably treat this once we sequence your genome and then use CRISPR to edit your genes. It goes the other way as well.
Yeah, I mean, you can't have a situation like that. And so actually, when I think about this, one possibility is that if you have a country that doesn't have a large private insurance system, it has more of a, you know, again, an NHS or something like that, you can actually see this kind of contributing to the bifurcation of the healthcare system, right? You can see if these tests and these approaches don't, on average, have huge returns for the healthcare system, and so the government doesn't really want to pay for them, but individuals, like really wealthy individuals, still want this kind of care, you can see more of them kind of trying to move off and get their own private insurance, have their, you know, pay for their own sort of concierge healthcare.
So, but what happens if they do have high returns? That's the real question which I have. What happens if there genuinely is this healthcare revolution that we were promised 20 years ago with the sequencing of the genome and hasn't arrived yet? But what happens if and when it does arrive, and that a bunch of brand new, extremely expensive technologies really can make us a lot healthier?
The hope a lot of people have is that you pay a lot up front with these technologies, and then you pay less in the future from these chronic diseases, from this end-of-life care, these end-of-life care issues. So, you know, I guess that's the optimistic case, right? That you edit your genes now for tens of thousands of dollars, but it prevents the insurer from having to pay tens of thousands of dollars, you know, $1 million later on down the line taking care of you when you're old and frail. So, I mean, there is this optimistic case. It just, I think a lot of people believe at this point we're sort of, you know, in this intermediate phase where the technology isn't that great yet. We're still understanding a lot of the basic, or trying to understand a lot of the basic science. And we're not going to get, it's not clear when we're going to get past that point.
So basically, best case scenario is rich people have eugenics. I'm just summing up here. Rich people will live in a perfect world with perfect children, and like they have access to eugenics.
You see, Jordan has this scenario where this is all used in a sort of preventative way, and I feel like the more likely scenario is that it's going to be used to cure diseases and treat symptoms much more than it's going to be used to prevent stuff, and that people are going to be turning up with, you know, cancer and saying, hey, there's a way of curing this cancer. It will cost $1 million totally. Because it's all going to have to get personalized. And people are going to find it very hard to say, no, we're not going to spend $1 million on curing your cancer just because it's too expensive.
So my friend Maki Inada actually got stage 4 lung cancer, and she had this weird gene that they said, oh, wait, we have a medicine that we think will work with this weird gene, Asian people with lung cancer. And it worked. But it was just very expensive. So I think that's and everybody touts it as like a wonderful example of personalized medicine. And it is, of course, and she's my friend. But I think you're right. That kind of thing, if it happens on a large scale, could be very, very expensive indeed.
So that's sort of genetic pharmacology. And that's, in a way, actually, that's one of the most promising places we are. It's looking at your genes and figuring out which medicines you're going to interact best with, react best to. And you see a lot of this actually in psychopharmacology, too. People are trying to figure out, like, which, you know, what your genes say about how to cure your depression kind of stuff. And weirdly, I'm a little bit more optimistic about that because the issue there is more, you know, pharmaceutical prices, right? Like, it's more the price of the actual treatment once they've identified the problem. And, you know, pharmaceutical prices are hard, treatment prices are hard, but you can figure out ways to deal with them.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Hey, listeners, whether you love true crime or comedies, celebrity interviews, news, or even motivational speakers, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue, right? And guess what? Now you can call the shots on your auto insurance, too. Enter the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. The Name Your Price tool puts you in charge of your auto insurance by working just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance. Then they'll show you a variety of coverages that fit within your budget, giving you options. Now, that's something you'll want to press play on. It's easy to start a quote, and you'll be able to choose the best option for you fast. It's just one of the many ways you can save with Progressive Insurance. Quote today at progressive.com to try the Name Your Price tool for yourself and join over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Okay, I think that's enough of vampires living forever. Let's have a numbers round, people.
I got a great number.
What's your number?
56. So my husband and I this morning were just shooting the shit about how excited we are that the Cubbies won.
Oh, and this is sports ball.
Right. I forgot that you don't even know the word baseball. So it was a really obviously very exciting moment. And if you're, by the way,
it was the first time that the team had won since the last time the team won.
Oh, my God. Yes. 108 years drought. 108 years. And we were wondering, well, is that really that rare?
Statistically speaking, isn't that just what you'd expect?
56% chance that there will be one team out of 30. There are currently 30 Major League Baseball teams that will go for a drought of 108 years. That's my number. We calculated that, assuming that it's random. It's not completely random. So,
And because it's not completely random, in fact, the probability is higher than 56%.
Right. That's right, because there'll be good teams that do it more often. So actually, and I should mention, though, that from 1920 to 1960, there were only 16 teams. So this number is actually only going forward. So, but if we have another 108 years of Major League Baseball, we should expect to see this.
And as the sports fan, Kathy?
Yeah.
There are 30 Major League Baseball teams.
Yes.
Which team do you think is most likely to be the one that doesn't win for the next 108 years?
I won't name names.
Let it be the Mets.
Jordan, what's your number?
My number is 32. 32. That is how many minutes, and this is election related, but it's close to my heart and makes me kind of sad. That is how many minutes the major networks, ABC, CBS, and NBC, have devoted to policy coverage this year, according to the Tyndall Report on their nightly newscasts. That is as opposed to 114 minutes in 2012 and 220 minutes in 2008, year-to-date at this point. So when you talk about how there's been no discussion of policy during this election, at least on television, we have some math to back that up.
Wow.
It's really true.
I want to cry.
Yeah.
And my number, I have to, since we're talking about Peter Thiel, my number is 31 million, which is the number of dollars that Gawker Media Group settled with Hulk Hogan for.
Oh,
so
yeah.
That lawsuit is now over. Gawker Media Group is the bankrupt entity which sold off all of its, or nearly all of its assets to my company, Univision. But they still had this $145 million judgment against them, but they have settled that for $31 million. There was a couple of other lawsuits which they settled at the same time for less than $1 million each. A lot of that money is going to this very evil lawyer in California called Charles Harder, who is bankrolled by
Peter Thiel.
Peter Thiel. So there's the Peter Thiel connection. It does leave probably a little bit of money left over for various other Gawker creditors, preferred shareholders, and the like. So I hope that this is there's a little silver lining to this. But the part of the really sad thing is that three posts are going to have to come down from Gawker.com. They're having to unpublish them, even though they were entirely true.
Mm.
Yep.
Anyway, on which depressing note, Mr. Peter Thiel, beyond the numbers round, there's something even more fabulous
so
that we need
exciting.
To end this on. What are you doing? And I'm talking here to you, dear listeners, because I know what I'm doing, and I know what Jordan's doing, and I know what Kathy's doing on Thursday, December the 15th. What are you doing? And are you going to be in New York City? Because if you are, Kathy, what are we going to be doing?
We're going to be doing a live craft beer episode, and we really want you guys to come.
It's going to be in Union Hall in Brooklyn. URL for buying tickets is in the show notes. So if you're a Slate Plus member, click on that and get 30% off the tickets. I'm pretty sure they're going to go very fast.
Yeah.
So buy your tickets now. Even if you can't come, send us an email. The email address, as you know, is always slatemoney@slate.com. And talk to us a little bit about not only what you want us to talk about in this show, but also who we should bring on, who we should be talking to on stage. And very specifically, these are people who need to be able to be in Brooklyn on December the 15th. And ideally, and we'd love some actual brewers, like people who make beer and struggle with the economics of it or succeed with the economics of it. And women would be great.
And, you know, people who will be willing to do it for free. That would be great.
We might give them a free beer.
Come drink beer with us.
Come drink beer with us. It's going to be weird and wonderful, fun craft beer episode, which will actually be an episode of Slate Money later this year if you can't make it in person. So that's going to be fun. Subscribe to Slate Money and you will hear that Slate Money craft beer episode at some point in the future. But for the time being, leave us a review, tell all your friends about us, and send lots of thanks to Virilyn Williams, who produced us today, Steve Lichtai and Andy Bowers, the executive producers, and check out all of the rest of the Panoply podcasts on itunes.com/Panoply. So we will talk to you next week on Slate Money.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.